Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is wrapping up a trip to China today that focused on the Biden administration's favorite new grievance, so-called overcapacity. The U.S. argues that China is producing too much in certain key areas of the economy. But what does this new complaint really mean?
We need a new system. We need a new society. We need to demand that which may have sounded impossible even a few weeks ago, but is not only realizable, but an imperative necessity.
We're very excited to have Professor Richard Wolff join us for a regular weekly segment where we discuss the biggest stories relating to the economy, the state of the working class, and the crimes of big business. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker. The Socialist Program brings you content several days a week thanks to the support of our patrons at patreon.com/thesocialistprogram. We appreciate all of your support and encourage you to become a patron today if you enjoy listening to the show. Richard Wolff is the co-founder of the organization Democracy at Work and the author of many books, the latest being The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. Check out all of his work at rdwolff.com. So, Professor Wolff, Janet Yellen was in China. You can tell that the PR people at the Biden administration were heavily involved in her trip because there is a key phrase that they kept hammering over and over again, overcapacity or excess capacity. What does this mean in the context of U.S. trade with China? What is it supposed to mean to the public, and what does it really mean behind the scenes?
Well, I'm glad you introduced the topic in terms of the public relations, because you have hit the proverbial nail right on the head. This trip was conceived by some PR advisors to President Biden. It's clear that they've never taken an economics course in their lives, because had they answered an exam question using the logic of their PR, their academic career would have come to a screeching halt. And let me explain, and before I do, mention again, I do not mean this in any way as a personal critique of Janet Yellen. She and I were students at the same time at Yale University getting our PhD degrees. She sat in the same classes I did, heard lectures from the same professors, read the same assigned books and articles. In short, I know that she knows better than what she was scripted to say on this trip. It really is astonishing. What in the world is excess capacity? Well, literally, it must mean that you have the capacity to produce more than you're actually producing. You have a certain excess capacity. And I have only really two things to show you the emptiness of what Janet Yellen had to speak, her lines, as it were. First, the Federal Reserve Bank here in the United States keeps a statistic. It has kept this statistic for decades. It is a statistic that all economists use from time to time, and I'm 100% sure that Janet Yellen in her career, both academic and in the government, has also had many occasions to look at. So she certainly knows what it is. It's also taught in every course that looks at these kinds of topics. The Federal Reserve keeps a statistic called capacity utilization. What it measures, get ready now, is the proportion of the capacity that is being used to produce here in the United States at any given time, and the proportion of our capacity that is excess in the sense that it is not currently being used to produce goods and services. It's capacity that is sitting idle, gathering rust and dust. And it's been important for the Federal Reserve to measure how much of our capacity is excess. The answer is it hovers around 75% of our capacity is being used, and approximately a quarter or 25% is excess. So when Janet Yellen or anybody around the president says the Chinese have excess capacity, they are noticing something that is true in almost every economy, some a bit more, some a bit less. And if you look at the statistic for the federal government here in the United States, you'll know that excess capacity rises and falls, say 5 or 6 percentage points above and below 75% utilization. So to pretend that suddenly we are all concerned about a statistic which applies to China and us and every other country that matters in the world is, I'm going to be polite now, disingenuous. But now here comes the more interesting economics of all of this. One of the industries that Janet Yellen was reported to have raised is the electric vehicle business, a very important business, and it'll teach us the emptiness of Janet Yellen's comments in yet another way. She pointed out, or she could have, I wasn't there, but she could have pointed out quite correctly that the Chinese have a capacity to produce electric vehicles that is larger than the quantity of electric vehicles they now in fact produce. The Chinese have been stunningly successful. They are now the world's number one producer of electric vehicles, very recently having surpassed Tesla, which had that record before. They even outsell Teslas inside China, where Tesla has a very large following. And why would the Chinese be so successful in electric vehicles? And it turns out that their number one company, BYD is the name of the company, produces electric vehicles that are in better quality and lower price, much lower price than anybody else, which is not surprisingly why they've been successful. And how is it that they're able to produce electric vehicles much more cheaply than American or European or Japanese have been able to do, at least so far? Here comes the answer. Because they have realized what we call economies of scale in economics. All that that means is you produce a quantity large enough that you can get the cost per unit down very low. The same has been found in computers, in clothing, in appliances. If you produce a large quantity, then you can get the cost per unit down so it's really competitive. And that's exactly what the Chinese have done, not just with electric vehicles, but with many other products. They build, here we go now, excess capacity. They build the capacity to produce huge quantities because that gets the price, the cost producing of each unit down to where they can offer it on the market at a lower price than other companies who haven't developed the excess capacity, the large capacity to do that. And by the way, this is done by every successful company. Ford and General Motors became the dominant automobile companies because they did that back in the 20th century and since. Many companies, American and other, that's a normal way of competition. You build excess capacity so you can get your unit cost down and thereby be more price competitive with others who didn't do it. The Chinese are not unique in doing this. They're not in any more likely to do it than anybody else. The whole thing is fake. That's the important thing, is to understand the logic here is fake. And by the way, let me tell you who notices that. Warren Buffett is one of the best known super wealthy billionaires in the United States. Huge numbers of people keep track of what shares of what companies he buys and sells, because they follow him and they repeat what he does because he has been so successful for so long. He comes out of the state of Nebraska, if I remember. He is extraordinarily well known. Guess what? He is a heavy investor in the BYD Chinese Electric Vehicle Corporation. He's already made a ton of money. Others have followed him. Major, huge equity capitalists in this country, hedge funds, and so are heavily invested in all these Chinese companies that are doing what we're supposed to believe Janet Yellen is scolding them for. This is nonsense. It is designed so that the government of Mr. Biden, worried about the election, has something to say so they can look like they are scolding China, reproaching China, wagging their finger, you shouldn't be doing this, hoping that people are not familiar with the history of capitalism that makes the creation of so-called excess capacity a normal, frequent, competitive strategy that capitalist corporations have used for a long time. Bottom line, shame on Secretary Yellen. That really is beneath her.
Thank you for laying that out, Professor Wolf. So, you know, a completely routine and typical thing, something that's essentially inevitable in a global supply chain, as you're explaining, building in excess capacity, the capacity right. to produce more and above the average. I mean, when it boils down to it, you know, this is a lot like the other grievances, the other economic grievances that U.S. or other Western officials raise, which is essentially that China's development strategy worked. I mean, I think that's really the core of their argument, right? You know, China was welcomed into the world capitalist economy on the basis of essentially low-end mass manufacturing. Manufacturing that doesn't involve adding a lot of value, relatively speaking, to goods, to products, and then exporting them in huge quantities onto the global market. You know, it's sort of the first step in the development strategy, but, you know, not the most lucrative one. So now that China is advancing, right, you know, is sort of emerging out of that initial stage of its development strategy and now producing things like solar panels, other green technologies, semiconductors. The fact that that has happened and essentially there has not been a political revolution in China, that the Chinese government hasn't been replaced by a pro-Western, pro-capitalist government. That is something that, you know, a lot of the business leaders, a lot of the economic planners were not expecting. And now they're essentially saying, cut it out. You're being too successful. You're producing too much. Your companies have been able to build in too much excess capacity in these key strategic sectors that are important to the future of the world economy.
Yeah, I think there's a lesson there that needs to be emphasized. The Chinese have been receiving lectures from Janet Yellen as Secretary of the Treasury and from a number of other high officials of Western and United States governments. And they've paid attention mostly to none of them. And the reason for that is simple. It's not that the Chinese don't learn from abroad. Absolutely not. I can tell you as a professor who has given lectures in many American universities all my life, that there are huge numbers of Chinese students that have been coming here for a long time to learn, sent by the Chinese government, by the Chinese Communist Party, because they knew they had a lot to learn from the United States in a whole host of areas. And they were respectful about that. The Chinese students came, they studied, they did very well. They went and took what they had learned back to their countries, as people from other countries do all the time. So this is not that the Chinese thumb their nose at the United States, not at all. But when it comes to getting economic advice, the Chinese laugh. Over the last 30 years, the number one goal in China has to stop being one of the poorest countries on earth, which it was for much of the 20th century, to become a modern, developed, technically sophisticated economy. And they've done that faster and better than any other country on this planet. You don't have to like what China is or does. You don't have to agree with them. That has nothing to do with it. It's a fact that they have been able to go from one of the poorest countries to the modern challenger of the United States, which was unthinkable for most other countries, and most other countries didn't achieve anything like that. So the Chinese are not going to take advice about how to manage their economy from people who come from countries who couldn't do it as well as the Chinese have year in and year out for the last 30 years. It's just silly to imagine otherwise. They are going to keep their mixture of state-owned and operated enterprises, that's roughly half their economy, privately owned and operated enterprises, that's the other half of their economy, supervised by a powerful government, in turn controlled by the Communist Party. That has proved to be an arrangement that gets you the results that you see in China. And I might mention, because it's not irrelevant, that the Chinese also made a decision not to engage in foreign wars for the last 30 years, but to take the money they didn't spend on wars and use it to develop their economy. They didn't establish 700-800 military bases around the world. They established none of them in order to save that money and to use it for economic development. They are not going to take lessons on how to do it differently. They've done extraordinarily well. And that not understanding that means that not only do the Americans giving them advice come across as arrogant, ignorant about what the Chinese have achieved, but they look a little ridiculous. And I, for one, wonder why the PR people around the president are so sure that the kind of talk they cheaply distribute around the world, clearly designed to impress an American audience that is not squared with in this conversation, why they don't worry about the absolute nonsense they spew and that is looked at in many other parts of the world for what it actually is.
So yeah, Professor Wolf, let's dig in deeper in terms of how this is all presented to and perceived by the public. You know, there's essentially one line of argumentation that, you know, protectionist policies, meaning, you know, imposing tariffs and other sorts of taxes and restrictions on the import and export of goods, that essentially is a pro-working class measure because it protects jobs in the United States and encourages the creation of jobs in the U.S. and not in other countries. There's another line of argumentation that essentially the net result of these types of policies are more expensive products because working people have to spend all or nearly all of their income on a month-to-month basis that actually ends up hurting working class people proportionately more. So these are not pro-working class policies. How do you deal with that debate?
Well, here's my view about this kind of debate. And there's a very famous essay written by Karl Marx, you know, 100 and whatever it is now, years ago, called Free Trade. And it was his analysis of that issue. Does putting tariffs and limits on trade help the working class or hurt the working class? And his answer, brilliant at the time and lost none of its luster, is equally valid today. And his answer was, this is not an issue that the working class has a vested interest in. Another way of saying it is, we never know. And what does he mean by that? He says, it's a mistake to think in simple terms as follows. If we put a tariff, I'm going to take an example. We have a tariff right now against Chinese electric vehicles. I'm going to use that example because we've been talking about it for the last little while on this program. It's a tariff of 27.5%. That's why the people listening to this program have probably never seen or sat in or driven a BYD Chinese electric vehicle. Everywhere else in the world, or at least in many, many parts, that's a regular part of what you see on the street. Europe is right now struggling with it. Latin America is full of BYD cars, but Americans haven't seen them. Why? The BYD car electric vehicle is better quality, and it's much cheaper than what we have. But when you add the 27.5% tax, because that's what a tariff is, it means the cheap car coming in from China becomes more expensive because an American buyer has to pay the cost of the car plus 27.5% tariff to Uncle Sam. Now, that's protectionism. And the way that the GM and Ford and the other car companies here were able to get that, and they fought for it, was because they're fearful of the competition from a superior, cheaper car, as well they ought to be. This way, they don't have that competition. If they had the competition, here's what they'd have to do. They'd have to offer electric vehicles at a competitive price with what comes from China. They'd have to improve their technology. They'd have to come up with cost savings of one kind or another. Now they don't have to do it. They can have the price of their electric vehicles very high because an American who wants an electric vehicle cannot buy a Chinese unless they pay even more than they would pay the American. So it gives American car companies who produce electric vehicles a much higher price because they don't have to compete. Now, is that good for the American working class? Here goes. Well, you might think somebody benefits. The workers in the American car companies are grateful that they still have their job. And they know that if they let the cheap Chinese cars come in, they might not keep a job because the American company couldn't compete. But we can't stop the reasoning there. If the prices in this country of electric vehicles are much higher than they would otherwise be because we exclude through tariff the Chinese import, then it means that any company in this country that wants to buy, say, an electric truck, and there's a whole big industry producing electric trucks in the United States, they're going to have to pay for that electric truck much more than they would be able to if they could access the Chinese electric truck, which is much cheaper. Now, the competitors of American companies, those in Europe, those in Asia, Africa, Latin America, they're all buying the Chinese truck much cheaper. They're going to be able, therefore, to lower the price of what they make using those trucks. And Americans having to pay much more for trucks, American companies won't be able to compete because when they buy an electric truck, they have to pay much more. How many Americans are going to lose their job because American companies can't sell goods abroad since the cost of their inputs is so much higher? The answer is you'd have to look at that and see. It might very well turn out, and there are plenty of studies that show this, that when you look at all the consequences, the number of jobs goes down. The wages people can earn in those jobs goes down. It turns out that protection isn't a one-way street to a secure job. It never was. You know what's going on here? What's going on here are some companies want cheap Chinese vehicles and trucks to come into the country. It's good for their business. Other American companies, like the competing auto companies, they don't want that because it's bad for their business. So we have a fight between the companies that want it and the companies that don't. And you know who will win? Who will persuade the government either to put a tariff on or not? It's the whichever side of those companies wins the support of the working class, can put the pressure of the working class on the government to tilt a little bit towards them. That's why you hear all this nonsense about it's going to be good for working people. The only tragedy is the unions, who often go along with this because they only represent a particular group of workers who may indeed be among those that are benefited. But if the working class as a whole understood what Marx laid out and what many have shown since, then they wouldn't fall for this game. The struggle between protection and free trade is not what the working class is or should be concerned about. They should be concerned about their problem, which is the employer class that dominates and controls them. And remember, Free trade is a way in which the world economy has grown spectacularly over the last 30 to 40 years. It is now being undone by companies that want government handouts and want government protection. That's all that's going on. There's nobody here fighting for what's good for the United States. Nobody has the time, the interest, or the money to do that. Those that are pushing for the end to free trade are the people who've got their hands out for the benefits they will get. And so you see in the world now, especially because of the success the Chinese have had, and secondarily many other countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, you're beginning to see more and more of the old capitalist countries of North America, Western Europe, and Japan, who used to champion free trade when the world was their oyster. They now, no longer the most efficient producers, no longer the dominant group in the world economy, they're turning to protection to slow down the competitors who have outcompeted them for the last 30 years.
So, Professor Wolf, the last question I want to ask you is along those lines. So People's Daily, you know, one of the most important publications in China, ran an editorial about Yellen's visit titled "Removing Barriers Good for U.S. China." And essentially the argument of the editorial is that there should be more openness and fewer restrictions, regulations, policies that interrupt or regulate economic relations between the United States and China. So like you're pointing out here, it's an interesting role reversal because for decades, the United States and allied institutions like the International Monetary Fund were going around and preaching the gospel as free trade, that the most important thing that any country can do is remove regulations that govern, you know, what entities, corporations, countries are allowed to do business inside your country. So now, you know, we have this commentary in People's Daily reflecting the view of the Chinese government. They're the ones who sound more like that, like they're for an open international trading arrangement. Are other countries looking at this change of tune from the United States and thinking, well, this is pretty hypocritical and the standing of the United States being diminished for that reason?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole world is watching the change, as you summarized it quite well, this change from globalism, if you like, neoliberalism, free trade, lots of words for it. Here's the United States now subsidizing computer chip companies, automobile companies, slapping tariffs. I mean, doing everything that is the opposite of what free trade and globalization and neoliberalism were all about. And there's no mystery to why this is. If China is allowed to produce the way they do, let's remember, they have a highly skilled labor force, used to disciplined industrial work. They have the largest and fastest growing market in the world. And now they have high technology, the equal of or superior to that in the places that used to be the home of high technology. Again, Western Europe, Japan, the United States. So they want an open world. There's nothing sophisticated about it, nor should it surprise anyone, because they know they're in the competitive position that can best take advantage of a free trade situation. And the United States knows it isn't. And it's introducing extraordinary uncertainty, because around the world, the industries that grew up being able to sell here in the United States, even though the goods were produced in Asia or Africa or Latin America, are all wondering and worrying, when will the United States close us out? Now that it's closing out China, who has power and nuclear weapons and all that, what's going to happen to our little country here in Asia, Africa, or Latin America? When will the United States decide they don't want to let us compete anymore in their market? They're watching a world change, and one of the things they're doing is saying, well, maybe we can, here we go now, get a better deal by not depending on the United States to stay open when it looks like it isn't. Let's make a deal with China. Let's develop our markets in China, or if not just in China, then in China and the countries like China in that grouping called the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and the other countries that have been joining them. You're seeing a whole shift in the world economy, and it is leaving the United States relatively less well off, relatively isolated, relatively turning in on itself, while the rest of the world utilizes those cheaper goods that free trade make possible to outcompete the United States. And I think this is going to have to be recognized, and that the failure of both Trump and Biden to face up to these issues, to come up with little gambits like excess capacity from the mouth of Janet Yellen, that's a make-believe. That's an attempt to distract people from the hard issues that we face into these silly little arguments that have no merit, are not true, and really count on people not knowing enough to be able to see through them.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We were joined by Professor Richard Wolff. He is the co-founder of the organization Democracy at Work, the author of many books, the latest being The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. Check out all of his work at rdwolf.com. You've been listening to The Socialist Program. We bring you content several days a week thanks to the support of our patrons at patreon.com/thesocialistprogram. We appreciate all of your support and encourage you to become a patron today if you enjoy listening to the show.
You've been listening to The Socialist Program with Brian Becker, where we bring you news and views about the world for those who want to change it. If you enjoyed the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and watch video episodes of our in-depth show, The Real Story, every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on YouTube with our partner, Breakthrough News. We can only continue our work bringing you high-quality news, analysis, and history with the support of our listeners. Connect with us and become a patron at patreon.com/thesocialistprogram and receive an invitation to participate in an exclusive monthly seminar with Brian Becker.